Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rory, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, we're going to speak with the Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield, on the 2019 session and what we can expect on the second half of this legislative term with 2020. But first, we are going to continue our series on most effective legislators of the 2019 calendar year. And today we are going to do our Democratic Legislator of the Year. Since we've begun these awards, we have had only Democratic Legislators of the Year because they've been in the minority since 2011 and do not have the same opportunities as the Republican majority to pass legislation and move certain bills. And so we've kind of portioned them off into their own category. And we've got several nominations. Again, our criteria for the award is the legislator who is the most effective, has shown a level of impact and a level of activity that exceeds that of his or her colleagues. We're going to have five nominations, and then we're going to go ahead and pick a winner. And let's go ahead and start with these. John, let's go with your nomination for Democrat of the Year.
All right, Kyle, I'd like to nominate House Democratic Leader Christine Gregg as this year's MERS Democrat of the Year. I'm advancing her name because throughout this year, she's shown an independent streak and an ability to work with her counterpart, House Speaker Lee Chatfield, when the ability of legislative leaders and the governor had clearly already broken down. Specifically, I think back to September 18 when we covered the agreement that she reached with Chatfield that brought Democratic support in for the House GOP education budget. That was taking place clearly at a time when Governor Whitmer, Senate Majority Leader Shirky, and Speaker Chatfield were not communicating. They were at an impasse, and she was willing to sort of sit down at the table. The other reason I nominate Gregg is, again, she was willing to step away from the governor on the road funding debate and, quite frankly, admit and be honest that the 45-cent gasoline tax was, I don't know if the dead on the arrival was the word she used, but she basically publicly said on the floor, this isn't going to go anywhere. It's just nice to see the leader of a partisan caucus be able to color outside the lines.
Well, and the other reason I like Christine Gregg, and it's a great nomination, is she was the leader of the only other caucus to put forward a roads funding plan in all of 2019. Neither of the Republican caucuses did it. The Senate Democrats did it, but the House Democrats did put forward a plan. And it did include some type of gas tax increase, but it also included other taxes, which I was surprised the governor didn't embrace, tax on business and a new and different idea on bridges. It was a different idea, and you could argue politically it wasn't going to go anywhere, but I think the numbers added up, and I thought it was a decent plan. So, and also I want to mention with Christine Gregg, her PAC numbers, continuing to advance the Democratic House position. Even though she's term limited, she has nothing at stake with whether the Democrats win majority in 2020 or not. She's still out there raising money. I believe she's the top PAC fundraiser in the Democratic caucus. And putting her caucus in a position to be successful, even though I do think House Speaker Chatfield is doing a bit better on that front. All right, Jack, let's get your nomination now for Democrat of the Year.
I'm going with, and it's after a great deal of thought that began last night and went back and forth and back and forth, with Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick.
And why Jim Ananick?
Okay, first of all, part of the reason it's so difficult is you're talking about a partnership between he and the other person I was considering, Senator Curtis Ertel Jr. And it's like they're in tandem. They basically have been working together, and it has partly to do with the difficulty of the way this year went. In my perspective is they both need to win an award for being able to walk on a tight wire with one leg tied behind their back and the other foot in a roller skate in terms of the dealing with the situation they've had with the budget situation and everything behind the scenes, and to some extent, you know, not behind the scenes. Having the two being equal as a partnership, the plus for Hertel, in my mind, was, well, you add to that the gaming package stuff. But against that, you have the plus for Ananick. I think he has had a much higher headache quotient of how many headaches he's had to deal with, how many things behind the scenes. And don't forget, he's also the leader of a caucus that's got a lot of new people.
And so when you're talking about the tight wire act that he's doing, this is between the Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and the Senate Majority Leader, Mike Shirky, both of whom have a great deal of respect for Senator Ananick.
Yeah, it's between them, around them, and who knows what else in terms of having credible patience. And this is not just Ananick. I mean, Senator Hertel, too, has been part of it. They have different styles. That's what it's kind of like, man, you know, I think they work together. I think they've, you know, both done an incredible job on that. But at the end of the day, I just basically almost a flip of the coin thought, okay, Senator Ananick has a few extra things that have been on his plate to have to deal with. So I ended up giving the nod to him. But, you know, don't wait 10 minutes. I might jump back and forth.
Well, you know, the other thing about Senator Ananick is that he's been working patiently behind the scenes on moving legislation in reaction to the Flint water crisis. And I know that's several years now in the rearview mirror, but it's not for him. And a lot of the issues that crisis brought up has still not been resolved legislatively when it comes to looking at testing water and making sure that water is safe when it gets from the source to the actual customer or the resident. And also the whole bureaucratic system of how do you manage a city that is in a financial crisis. And we haven't had to do that in the last couple of years because the economy's a little better than it was in 2008, 2009, 2010. But the reforms that have come out from the Jim Stomas Commission, and that's been a couple of years, but he's been consistently pushing it, and now we actually have bipartisan bills out there. And I don't think it's in a small part to Senator Ananick making sure they're out there. And I wouldn't be surprised if they start getting some action, some movement this coming year in 2020.
Yes, and in this era of instant rhetorical gratification, the idea of patience is kind of, you know, it's really worth noting.
All right. All right, Mike, let's go to your nomination here for Democrat of the Year.
Yeah, I'd like to nominate Representative David LeGrand. He's been involved in quite a number of packages this year, especially on the criminal justice reform and side of things. He was involved in the very first thing out of the gate, which was a civil asset forfeiture. He had a bill in that package. He's been part of the Raise the Age package. He's been part of the expungement package. He also has another package that hasn't gotten much attention yet, but I think it's a very important piece of criminal justice reform, and that's bail reform. And he makes a very strong case for it. You've got poor people in this state who have trouble coming up with $400 for a sudden expense. And if your sudden expense is bail, today you may end up sitting in the jail for a while until you can get some money around. That really screws up people's lives. I mean, you lose your job. Without a job, you can't have housing. You may lose your family. This is important stuff. And the fact that LeGrand is an attorney, he's recognized these things about the system that need to be fixed, and so he's very active. Now, you might want to criticize a Democrat for lightening the penalties on criminals, but he also is part of a package with Representative Mike Mueller to increase the penalties for somebody who tries to take a gun from a police officer. And he points out that when somebody, whether they snatch a gun by surprise or try to take it by force, when somebody takes a gun from a police officer, bad things happen. So he wants to increase the penalties there. He's had some other very interesting bills that are moving through to make sure that the Auditor General has access to records. I would have thought that that was a given, but there are a number of sections of law that say records have confidentiality, and some departments have concluded that that means that the the Auditor General can't get access to them. Grand has a bill to make it clear that, oh, no, the Auditor General gets that access.
And well, not only does he have the bill, that bill was wrapped into the final budget package along with the legislation from Steve Johnson. They were signed together to make it clear that the Auditor General can look into these departments and access confidential records as long as they keep it confidential as well.
Right, exactly. And then he has a package on financial disclosure for state lawmakers that he's pushing through, and it's getting some traction.
And I want to comment on that one as well, because that's an issue that he's been working on for a couple terms now. But the difference this term is that he got a good amount of Republicans to sign on with him as well. And he's working across the aisle, and he's working across the Capitol Rotunda in the Senate and trying to get some movement on it as well, making it so that folks, when they're running for office, have to fill out something similar to what folks who are running for Congress have to fill out that show where you're getting your money from, where your spouse is getting your money from, what's your net worth, so folks know a little bit about your background before you go ahead and run for office.
Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of these packages that I've been mentioning are bipartisan, and that's one of the reasons that they're moving. Working across the aisle is very much a part of what Representative LeGrand does. I did want to mention that he also has a bill in the Child Protective Services package, which would require more reports from CPS to the legislature for better oversight. So he's been quite active and been getting a lot of traction for a person who's in the minority. Often the minority has a hard time getting bills to move. He's gotten a lot of bills to move. One more thing that I want to mention about Representative LeGrand is that he should be one of everybody's favorite representatives because he owns a distillery.
Well, he certainly checks all the boxes for effective level of activity and impact. He checks all three of the boxes. So great nomination. Thanks, Mike. All right, Jacob Kanzler, let's get to your nominee for Democrat of the Year.
All right, so I'm nominating Representative Yusuf Rabi from Ann Arbor. A couple of reasons why. When I was looking through what Rabi did this year, I didn't even bother to count the number of bill packages this guy is on. I mean, he's showing up at like every single Democratic bill package press conference. Just a few I was able to find in the past few months. He's on the anti-Nestle bills, banning exporting water in small containers. He went across the aisle to help with the ending mega tax credits bill. He's on the electric vehicle charging station package, a civil rights education package. I mean, House Dems, you know, they put out a lot of bills, a lot of bill packages, trying to get their priorities across, and Rabi makes himself a part of a lot of them. So,
including the road package, too, that they put out.
Yes.
Road package and also the solar panel package. He's been involved in that as well.
Yeah, and on the solar panel one, that was his one public act this year, and I was going to say it's no small cheese. I mean, you can say you're giving people a property tax break, and you're also helping people do renewable energy. So I imagine that would play great back in his district in Ann Arbor. And then the last thing, I mean, I guess Representative Rabi has made himself a vocal leader of the caucus. You know, he's the House Minority Floor Leader, and we've seen from him this year and in the past, he's always ready to give a floor speech on the Dems' positions on bills. And, you know, that's an important role, especially when Republicans are passing legislation that they support but are not necessarily going to talk about. Dems get up there and tell people why people should be voting for it. And so Representative Rabi makes his case stated very passionately, and it's an important role for the caucus. So for these reasons, we got Representative Yusuf Rabi as a Democrat of the Year.
Now, remind me, Jacob, the environmental contamination in Ann Arbor in the groundwater. You remember that particular issue? The DEQ is trying to put a handle on this contamination in the groundwater in Ann Arbor. It had to do with an old, some type of manufacturing plant. The details are a little fuzzy for me, but I remember Yusuf Rabi as being very involved in that issue as well.
Oh, yeah. He's been a vocal leader on that. I think it's actually in the past spurred a lot of his work and criticism of the state government and kind of how they're regulating, looking after the issue. It spurred a lot of his environmental work. And so Definitely you see that reflected in what he does.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and make my nomination, guys. I had a lot to choose from here. There was several legislators, particularly in the House, who I thought were particularly active. Just to name a few, Robert Wittenberg staying active on that red flag legislation, pushing the graduated income tax legislation. He even had a PA with the cryptocurrency stuff. And he's also got a bill passed the House with the outdated audible signal. You got Sherry Gay Dignago. She got an amendment onto the payday lending bill and was involved in the expungement debate. She's got a bill in that package and was certainly very active in the auto no-fault debate, representing a certain segment of the city of Detroit. Of course, Donald Lozinski, as the campaign chair, had a very active year. Kevin Hertel was very active in the switch debate, got the unions on board. That particular bill got that moved out of the House with some Democratic support. Representative Rebecca Warren. Rebecca Warren is the Dean of the House of Representatives. She has served her four terms in the House prior, then was over in the Senate, served two terms in the Senate. So we'll be getting the full mileage out of the state's term limits. And I think she's shown her experience in the legislative session in the House. She's involved back again in the recreational passport debate and trying to make that an opt-out program instead of an opt-in, working with Republican Chair Gary Howell, and really has, I think, struck a good balance between somebody who's effective in being able to work across the aisle while also pushing stuff that is core to her beliefs, whether that's abortion rights, or if that is banning for-profit charter schools from being in the state. She's also been carrying the water for the governor on the gaming expansion package.
So a lot of good lawmakers have had very productive years. But I don't think it's hyperbole to say that there hasn't been a legislator on the minority side who has had as productive of a year as Senator Curtis Hertel. I was taking a look at all of the bills that he's had a part in: the gaming expansion, surprise billing, Medicaid work requirement fix, domestic violence legislation. He was taking the bullet and introducing bills to eliminate sunsets on various fees that got signed into law. He had a bill in the Raise the Age package. He was the bridge between the governor and the Republican majority on the legislature in dealing with the budget. It seemed like Curtis Hertel was everywhere this past year, involved in many different items, policy on the budget. And then he's still remained extremely active on the campaign front. He was the lead Democrat in the campaign cycle in 2018 and continues to help his caucus, even though under term limits, he won't be around after this current term is done. So for all of these reasons, his accessibility to the public, letting everyone know what's going on, where his mind is, being open to the media and working with his colleagues, I'm very proud to nominate Senator Curtis Hertel as Democrat of the Year. Okay, after some consideration and speaking with the folks here at MERS, we are going to name Senator Curtis Hertel our Democratic Legislator of the Year. Let's just go ahead and think about this for a minute. The public acts that Senator Hertel has had, six public acts. I mean, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. Having six this year, when we haven't had that many altogether, is quite remarkable. He's basically been involved in all major pieces of legislation this year, whether it's Raise the Age, Medicaid work requirements, the gaming package. He was also a lead negotiator for the Democrats between the governor and the Senate majority leader, and was actively involved in the crafting of what ended up being the supplemental. Was in, really, I think, the governor's kitchen cabinet as far as strategy involved with the budget. Just been extremely active. He checks all three boxes. He can work with Republicans and get bills done. He's had an impact in that stuff that he's done behind the scenes. Has been able to advance and get things into the budget that we probably don't even know about. And he's been extremely active. So exemplifies what we're looking for with this type of award. So Senator Curtis Hertel, for the second year in a row, is going to be named our Democratic Legislator of the Year. Okay, with that, we are going to go now to our year-end interview with the Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield. Joining us now for the podcast is the Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield. We are live in the state capitol in the Speaker's office. Thanks for making some time with us.
Kyle, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, let's talk about one of the big issues of 2019, which was the passage of no-fault auto insurance reform. Going into 2020, is there going to need to be some type of cleanup legislation? And to what extent is there going to have to be some revisions to what you all did this year?
Well, first let me say that this reform had eluded our state for over 30 years. And it maybe took and required divided government in order for us to come together and get it done. So I'm very proud of the work product, very proud of Speaker Pro Tem Wentworth and the select committee we had on car insurance to finally, in my opinion, put people above stakeholders and come to an agreement. Having said that, I'm also a believer anytime you have a major reform like car insurance, it's going to require alterations heading into the future. And how I've described it to people, Kyle, is we blazed the trail. We showed how to get it done. But I fully anticipate this legislature and even future legislatures putting in some guardrails and maybe paving the road, making it smoother to drive on. But I'm very, very proud of our product that we came together in divided government, reached a consensus. But there will no doubt need to be alterations.
So how major of alterations are we talking about?
Well, that'll be determined by future legislatures. We did what we thought the right thing was, and at the end of the day, we did what we could get the votes for.
But I'm talking on 2020. Well, you're still Speaker. Are there rough edges that need to be smoothed out?
We're going to listen to different groups as this gets implemented and see how we can make it better. And there's no pride of authorship on this was our original plan, and here's what we're willing to do. We need to have a listening ear. That's what I am convinced did not happen for 30 years with car insurance, and I don't think we set that standard moving forward. So had a big reform, but we need to be willing to alter it if it needs alterations. But at the end of the day, if it serves the people that it be altered, we should do it. If it only serves stakeholders, then we should keep it as is.
You mentioned roads, and of course, roads will probably be a discussion point in 2020. There are some out there who would suggest that the House would not want to take up anything to raise additional revenue during an election year. Is that a foregone conclusion that the House would not raise additional revenue in 2020 for the roads?
Well, let me walk you back a little bit. I don't think anyone wants to raise revenue in an election year. And the flag that I've staked into the ground, I'm going to remain heading into 2020. And that is, before I have a conversation about new revenue, two things have to happen first. Number one, we have to ensure that we are dedicating all revenue that's being paid in taxes at the pump towards roads. And number two, that we are reprioritizing what we already have. And I'm a believer, before you go back into the pockets of taxpayers, they've got to see that you are willing to prioritize and make tough decisions with the budget. If we can accomplish those two things, Kyle, we can then begin having a conversation on what is needed to fully fund our roads and ensure that we have an infrastructure that works for everyone and every region of our state. But I'm not going to jump the gun and have the third conversation before we accomplish the first two.
But you've talked with the governor an entire year. I mean, surely you've gotten some assurances that you've gotten past step one and step two.
We accomplished a lot in 2019. Roads was not one of them, right? And we're going to carry over that conversation heading into next year. But I can give you one commitment that you can take to the bank. We're not going to let politics get in the way of passing a good roads plan. We certainly do have disagreements, right? But we also have agreements that we can build on. I think everyone in the state agrees the 45-cent gas tax was not a reasonable or pragmatic proposal. So I look forward to seeing the governor's new proposal. But at the same time, we've got to come to a consensus on something.
So you're not saying hell no to a gas tax vote, correct?
I'm saying we got to get these first two things done first. We need to ensure that all money paid at the pump goes towards roads. And I'm going to tell you this, Kyle, that's not just what I believe as someone who's an elected official. It's what every single person in the state believes. It's common sense that what you pay in taxes at the pump goes towards roads. Imagine if we had nearly $900 million a year going towards our roads in additional revenue. Our roads would not be in the condition that they're in. That's the main problem. And too often, we focus on a symptom. A symptom is our roads are in poor condition. The root of the problem is not all the money we're paying in taxes goes towards roads. We have to fix the root of the problem before we start looking at symptoms.
Do you support the proposal by Jack O'Malley to have a local option for municipalities to raise their own gas tax and registration to fix their own roads?
I think it's important that we give locals real tools to fix issues that are regional. The governor's proposal that she put out raised the gas tax 45 cents on every single area and region of our state, but the money went towards Southeast Michigan, and I think that's unfair. I think if Southeast Michigan wants to fix their own roads, they should have the opportunity to do that. And Michigan is an outlier in that. We give our locals very few opportunities, and I think there's multiple ways we can look at to untie the hands of locals when it comes to millages. That is one of the areas I think we need to have a conversation about.
Now, one of the other things that is going to spill over into 2020 are some of the things that Governor Whitmer vetoed or used line item veto power over that didn't get put in last year's supplemental. Is there anything in particular that you would like to see restored that maybe didn't get restored in the first supplemental?
Well, what we did in the supplemental that passed right before the end of the year was put in there everything that we could agree on, and we made the decision that we would table all other conversations until we head into January. So I know there'll be a time here when the governor, majority leader, and I get back together. We'll work through our appropriations chairs and budget director, and we'll begin having that conversation on what a next step supplemental could potentially look like.
Is there anything in particular that you like, though?
I'm committed to being at the table and having that conversation with them. I don't want to get ahead of myself and start negotiating against myself. But I tell you what, there will be some things that are priorities of the House, and I'm sure the Senate and the administration will have their priorities. And we have to be willing to sit down at a table and come to a consensus with the same type of leadership it took to get this one done in December.
Is additional general fund revenue for the roads part of that?
It's something I'd like to see, but I'll tell you this right now, I'm certainly not going to begin negotiations, though as much as I appreciate and respect the MERS podcast, start negotiations through the podcast, but that'll be something that we want to see, and that's an indicator to the people of our state that we are ready and willing to reprioritize existing funds, and I think it's important that we do that if the roads are important to us.
Now, one of the things that the governor would really like to see is this Michigan Reconnect program that she's talking about to provide last dollar community college for non-traditional students. Just on its face, what do you think of the idea of the state expanding community college opportunities to non-traditional students?
Well, first let me say I think the state has come a long way in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, the problem was you drive around and there were no jobs available. Now you drive around and you can't help but see help wanted signs. There are so many jobs available in our state. We just don't have the workforce that is equipped and prepared to assume the jobs. So I think any program that looks at, you know, employing and enabling and also educating adults to take these jobs is a good step. On its face, Michigan Reconnect can be a good idea if it's fully vetted. And it is something heading into this next year that I know will be a part of the conversation. We want to ensure we have a skilled and ready workforce. That can be the way to do it. And I want to make sure that we fully vet out the issue and ensure that we implement something that's responsible.
Couple other subjects that I wanted to touch on you with. The Good Jobs program is going to be expiring at the end of the year. There is a proposal in the Senate to remove the sunset, stretch it out another 4 or 5 years. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, before we do it, we will have to see some very tangible evidence of how the program either worked or failed in the last couple of years. That's very important. Before you ever re-implement a plan like that, the proof is in the pudding. Did it work? Did any of the jobs that came to our state, would they not have come had Good Jobs not been implemented? And I can assure you that the House will be fully vetting any proposal to reinstate that program.
Do you remember if you were a yes or a no on this originally?
I was a no on Good Jobs last time around.
Why?
At that time, I didn't have the evidence in front of me that was presented to convince me that the program would work. I don't remember all the fine details of the plan, but I remember I was not fully convinced at that time that it would work. However, now it's important to, you know, that these groups, these stakeholders, bring forward the evidence to the House, to the Senate, to the administration, and see if we can come to an agreement on how to responsibly implement the plan. So, made no decisions on Good Jobs, but before we make any affirmative decision, I think we need to see some real evidence that the plan worked.
Are you okay with getting rid of the Pure Michigan campaign as far as state money going toward it? Is it time to pull the plug on it and let the industry pay for it?
I think Pure Michigan has worked for our state. And speaking from someone born and raised in Northern Michigan, it certainly benefited Northern Michigan. So I think it's important that we do have a program put in place to ensure that we can promote our state. How that works moving forward, I think we have to have that conversation and what's the most responsible way to do it for the taxpayers of our state.
Regional transit. Obviously, you know about this proposal to try and raise additional revenue in Southeast Michigan for Oakland, Washtenaw, and Wayne County. Is that something that you're okay supporting?
I'm definitely open to the idea. What I can tell you is this, Kyle. I'm sick and tired of sending my constituents' taxpayer dollars down to Southeast and Southwest Michigan for mass transit. Our constituents don't benefit from it, and yet we're taking millions of dollars, my taxpayer dollars from the 107th, to fund transit in Southeast Michigan. I think that's wrong. However, if I'm going to, as Speaker of the House, say that's wrong, I think it's only responsible that we look at giving them ways to do it without siphoning money from the general fund, without siphoning money from taxpayers in Northern Michigan. If Southeast needs it, then Southeast can fund it. So I think it's important that we allow locals the tools to raise their own revenue. And I say that as someone being from Northern Michigan. Now, how it's done is up for debate, and that's why we're having the conversation right now. There's certainly some additional politics being played in Oakland County and some other regions of Southeast Michigan that I don't intend to step in, and they need to play that out on their own.
Have you met with voters, not politicians, lately?
Personally, no. I've been pretty wrapped up in this budget negotiation and reaching consensus, which we did and I'm proud of. But I do know that we've had several meetings, whether legal counsel and senior staff, with Voters Not Politicians, as well as with the Senate, to ensure that if we put together a proposal, it's something that's responsible for the people of our state. And I know both chambers and VNP all have their own priorities they'd like to see done.
Do you still think it's possible that you guys can come together on something anytime soon? I know you had hoped that something would come together this month.
I absolutely believe it's possible we come together with an agreement on a proposal. You know, it's no surprise to anyone in this town. The Senate had talked about reforming term limits. Mm-hmm. VNP had come together with a couple ideas they had of reforming lobby laws. And the House came together with what we felt was a good ethics package to be passed. All ideas are on the table, and we're currently deliberating about what the most responsible plan would be to present to the people of our state. But I think this is a good example, Kyle, that we can learn in divided government. You can have disagreements with stakeholders, you can have disagreements with the administration, but no past disagreement should stop you from finding an area to agree on in the future, and that's what we're doing right now.
How do you think the Ways and Means Committee's done?
I think the Ways and Means Committee has worked exactly how it was intended to give a second pair of eyes to every single bill before it passes the chamber, and also to ensure that when a bill hits the floor, it is ready for a vote. I can tell you this, with being in leadership last term, a majority of my time was spent amending and reforming bills that were already on the floor. Doing that prevented me from focusing on big ticket items. And the Ways and Means Committee has worked incredibly well, because I don't know about most people in town, but I did not run on the platform of elect me so I can go pass more laws. And I think most people would agree with that. So I think it's helped us. It's prevented us from passing an overburdensome amount of bills. And because of that, it's allowed us to focus on the big ticket items. And what I can tell you is this, car insurance would not have been reformed without Ways and Means.
Really? Why do you say that?
Ways and Means was a way to further vet other ideas and other bills. And because of that, it provided a proper amount of time for myself, for the Speaker Pro Tem, to do our legwork with car insurance. Without Ways and Means, I would not have been able to devote more time to reaching a consensus on this budget impasse. And that is needed for any leader, whether it's the Senate, the Speaker, or the administration. Focus on the big ticket items and be able to have enough time to negotiate. That's what Ways and Means has done.
Well, that's a different perspective, because maybe some of our listeners have felt like Ways and Means is just another added step to the process, and it looks like it's just a rubber stamp to what the subcommittees have done. And there's not a lot of deliberation. Sometimes there's not any testimony. It just seems it's just shoving things forward.
I mean, Ways and Means Committee is a process that's utilized by many states around the country. It's a dual review process that's also utilized by Congress. It ensures that what we're passing is good and responsible for the people of our state. When you look at this year, we passed fewer than 200 bills out of the House, or that 200, maybe fewer than 200 PAs have been signed by the governor.
Yeah.
Factor that with we passed over 400 bills in lame duck last year. I don't think any one person in the state, even those that are elected, looked at lame duck of last year and said that was a good process by having hundreds and hundreds of bills sitting on the floor. I think if a bill's on the floor, that means that it's ready to go and the legislators are ready to vote on it. Too often in the past, and I'm speaking from personal experience as a committee chair, you kicked something to the floor to, quote, continue the conversation. And I think that mindset needs to end. You know, in the past, in Michigan, 60s and the 70s, you know, a lot of leaders had a rule, if a bill was on the floor for 3 weeks, it got sent back to committee. Whatever the process is, something had to change. And that was conversations I've had with a lot of former speakers of Michigan, different leaders from around the state, and said, what would you change if you were back in office? And slowing the process down was something that many of them said. So I'm very proud of the product we've had. I think it's worked incredibly well.
Larry Inman, are you ready to give him back his office allotment and his staff, or do you think that the House should still push forward on expulsion?
Well, at this point, nothing has changed, and we still have, you know, a colleague that's a part of the House chamber that is still under a federal indictment, and we still have a colleague, a part of our chamber, that has admitted to sending text messages that all of us have read by now. So I met with Representative Inman on the last day of session and informed him that nothing was going to change, and every punitive action that was taken by the House is going to stand. As Speaker, I'm going to continue to evaluate how this potential next trial moves forward. And something I've committed to the House Republican leadership team and to Minority Leader Greg, that we're going to take this one step at a time. And we're going to make sure that the House of Representatives is held to a high standard. And I think that's what we've done so far.
What's been the most challenging part of being Speaker?
So I think there's a couple items. You know, number one is always trying to find the balance of how do you maintain your personal, sincerely held beliefs and your principles while also compromising on policy to move the state forward. And that requires an element of pragmatism when you're at the table, making sure that any proposal you're coming to the table with is reasonable, that can be agreed upon, and not letting past disagreements stop you from moving forward on other items. Number two, I think any leader will tell you this, you know, there have certainly been personal demands of this job that have taken me away from my district more than I would like, therefore also my family. But, you know, it's something that you keep things in perspective, and you continue to work hard, and, you know, this too shall pass. You know, fortunately for me right now in Michigan, there are term limits. I would say finding areas to reach a consensus on. You know, I am a state representative, but at the same time, I'm Speaker of the House. And where do those lines meet is up for debate.
If there were no term limits, would you run for re-election next year?
That's a tough hypothetical that I have not thought of. I could also say if there weren't term limits, I might not be here, right? Because it creates very fast-moving revolving doors. So that's a tough position. I would say probably at this point, if there were no term limits, there's already people looking at running for office in my seat, so maybe not.
I saw you were in Washington, D.C. recently for mm-hmm. the Christmas party at the White House. Tell us about that.
Yeah, an incredible experience. You know, I've had the unique opportunity to visit the White House now several times. This was the first Christmas party I've been at. I could not attend last year's. It was a neat experience, you know, being in the White House during that season. My wife and I really appreciated it. Seeing, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Trump in their home. They were very kind. So I've now attended the Christmas party of our governor and the Christmas party of our president. So showing some real bipartisanship here.
How do you think he's done? Do you think he's going to win Michigan again? And if so, why?
I don't think we've seen a president in my lifetime live up to the promises that he has made. The president has done exactly what he said he was going to do. And because of that, I think most of the country has got their mind made up on Trump. And I think the people of our state care more about the jobs. They care more about the economy, making sure they've got money in their pocket to put food on the table. And let me tell you this, right now, our economy is doing well, and there are a lot of jobs available. So I think because of that, Trump's got a real opportunity to win Michigan again. But an even bigger fact is that we're even talking about Michigan. The fact that we're talking about Michigan right now on this podcast should frighten every single Democrat in this country, because Michigan was never in play. I think the people of our state care more about jobs than they do some overly partisan impeachment sham, and I think that's what we're seeing in Washington right now.
How active are you going to be in 2020 with the House elections? You're not going to be up, and you're not going to have to live with the results, so you could theoretically just focus on doing the job here and spend more time at home if you wanted to.
Yeah, that's not my mindset, and that's not what I signed up for, and I don't think that's what the caucus chose me to be the leader for. It's going to be my goal to ensure there's no one who works harder to retain Republican majority than myself, and I think our House leadership team has done an incredible job setting up our chamber for success next year. When you look at the work that we've put into recruitment, ensuring we have good candidates, and also fundraising, we have a 5-to-1 cash on hand advantage over the House Democrats. That has never happened before. We've raised more money than the House Republicans have ever done before. And I think that's because we've got a great team. And in our House Republican Caucus, we operate as a family. Because of that, we're all pulling the same direction. And because of that, we've had a lot of success. So my focus is twofold next year. Number one, ensure that we have good policy that passes our chamber. And number two, that after the 2020 elections, House Republicans come back with the gavel. And I fully anticipate that's going to happen.
Are you going to create a Chatfield Leadership Fund for?
I'm definitely looking at it. I think I'm always looking at ways that we can raise more money for our caucus. And everything I can do to set up this caucus for success this next year, I'm going to do. I love every single one of the members I serve with, and I want them to be successful. And I think they all know that they belong to the team, and I want them to know that I've got their back. And those that are coming back have a shared future, and I want to contribute to that and do everything I can to serve those around me and set them up for success. I could not be more proud of the team of members that I get to serve with on a daily basis. And I think people in this town have seen because of our unity, because we've stuck together, we've led in this town on many key issues this year, and I fully anticipate that happening again heading into next year.
Last question here. Going into next year, if you get one policy item done next year, what would it be?
I think it's to have a responsible roads plan pass. I think the people of our state deserve it, and we need to be willing to meet in the middle, reach a consensus, and ensure that our roads are funded. And I will also say that, Kyle, but I want to add two more things. I want to see a smooth implementation of our car insurance that we passed, and also I want to see Line 5 move forward. That was passed by the legislature, signed into law, and that's a big issue for our district, for my district up north. So, listen, we need to fix our roads, but we need to see other laws that were previously passed and signed into law move forward with a smooth implementation. I'm excited about it. I think we've had a good first year, and I'm excited about what 2020 can bring.
Lee Chatfield, Speaker of the House, thanks for the time today.
You bet. Always a pleasure. Look forward to next time.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Appreciate the speaker taking some time with us here today. Thanks to the boss, John Murray, Jack, Mike, and Jacob. Also, thanks to AT&T. For sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, when we're going to name our House Member of the Year and Senator of the Year, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care.